Aren't you too old to comprehend that there's a new mood in the world? There are new beings. There is youth that doesn't accept the inevitability of this war. Well, I'm prepared to think I could be too old to think that particular thought. But I would say about that, how many millions of years have men been throwing things at each other? And what is the meaning of mass inertia? Is inertia a fact or not? Does anybody doubt it? Well, once upon a time, long, long ago, when I was a little girl, you know, we're all little girls, aren't we? It's true. Before we developed our excrescences, we were all little girls. That means to say, we're all fundamentally willful, not rational. Rationality occurred much later. Long, long ago, when I was a little girl, a brother of mine called Cain murdered his brother Abel. Not the one of that name here tonight. And he did it simply by rising up against him physically, coming within striking distance and smiting him a deadly blow. Now, he said afterwards, "Every man's hand will be against me. I'd better retire." So he went away east of Eden to the land of Nod, which means he went into deep meditation and melancholy. And he then built a city and said, "I will be safe if I give birth to my own children, who will undoubtedly be grateful to Daddy for having given birth to them. And behold, they will not smite their Daddy." One of them was the previous incarnation of Sigmund Freud, who invented the Oedipus complex. And the brothers in that city built by Cain began slaying each other. And in a few generations, one called Lamech said, "God said seven times vengeance for anybody hurting Cain. Well, for me, Lamech, 70 times seven protection is needed." In the city of Cain, almost everybody was a murderer. Why? Well, the father was a murderer, was guilty, suspected everybody of wanting revenge, and brought up his children in the spirit of himself. So they all expected to be murdered, so they engaged in self-protection. Now, it wasn't very long before it was necessary to flood the earth to try to teach people good manners. And it didn't work. And God repented that he had made man. He said, "What a horrible mess man was." But God is very persistent. He's even more persistent than a pig, believe it or not. In fact, it's a free translation of the word pig by sound shift into theos, the God. Now, God is the most persistent being there is, but he's persistent in spirit, whereas ordinary type pigs are persistent in matter. Now, we've had many, many thousands of years, 6,000 written history, and about at least a million unwritten history, where every man has been busy slaughtering every other man that coveted his neighbor's wife or ass or whatever he possessed. Now, until possessiveness, until acquisitiveness is destroyed in every man by self-development internally, there will be disagreements about who is going to possess what. Now, to think that I'm too old to contemplate this problem is not correct. I'm old enough to have seen two major wars and several million smaller wars, including within my own family, over a box of paints or something like that. As long as we individually covet things possessed by other individuals, we have the ground of a war. And then the only difference is this: how big are the weapons we actually command, possess, and can use? If rude words will do it, that will do. If chicanery in business will do, that will do. If a shootout will do, with the police or with each other, rival gangs, that will do. If nuclear weapons are necessary, they will do. But it's an inherent tendency in the human race to carry the thing on logically to the final term. There's one thing we love doing, going to the end of the road. Have you noticed that persistence in yourself? A tendency when you commit yourself to a course to go along to the end of the road, to make quite sure that you know what the end of the road is. And when God said, in that biblical version, I will no more flood the earth, his voice was heard to say, the next time, fire. That's a very old rabbinical doctrine, that the earth is periodically, cyclically destroyed by alternations of fire and water. You know that a large number of floods and things occur on the earth periodically, and you also know that volcanic eruptions and earthquakes occur, and these were called by the rabbis alternations of fire and water. The actual shape of the earth on which we live is different from what it was millions of years ago. And there were beings living on earth long, long ago, long before our external historians believed. When I was a kiddie, there were enough people around thinking that man was created in 4004 BC, according to Archbishop Usher. He even knew what time of the day it was when God started to create. And he wrote it in a book, as Lewis Carroll says, and if it's in a book, it must be true. Now, since then, it has been discovered by anthropologists and by archaeologists that man is older than 4004 BC. He goes back 20 million. He goes back further and further and further. Man is much older than people like to think. But from the very beginning, he has showed marks of egotistic coveting of the values of other beings. And when driven, he has fought physically for them. Now, I cannot rule out the possibility of a new emergent, a quantum jump, a mutant child who's so brilliantly intelligent that he won't fight anybody ever again. But I don't see any evidence for this in the young people I know, and I know a lot of them, and I work with a lot of them. Students in their teens and in their 20s, they're just as aggressive as we were, just as covetous, just as destructive. I mean, spraying a member of parliament with paint is a mild form of violence. But given a gun, he would have got that instead of the paint. The youth of today is not less violent than the youth of my day. When I was in my teens, vandalism was common, violence was common. We didn't use today's weapons. We used very primitive weapons, like potatoes full of razor blades on the end of string. Mild things like that. You whirl them round and throw them in the crowd, and delight in the howls that come from people you don't know who've been struck and who deserve to be struck because they were there. You remember in the film Zulu, where the young officer says to the old lag, when the Zulus are about to attack in their thousands, why should this happen to us? And he replied, because we're here, sir. Now, we are on earth, and I don't know whether you know, but it's admitted by most intelligent sages of several thousand years, the earth is a lunatic asylum for the universe. Nobody on earth is very well. Now, when I was a kid in mental hospitals, it used to be the practice to beat people up by various subtle ways, like you gave them what was then called a black draft, It totally purged them so they couldn't move. And they were called pacified. Today you give them drug equivalents so you can have a quiet night. In a mental hospital, they used to be screaming really funny noises in the middle of the night. And today you don't hear them. Why? Because we have solved the problem of the conferring of peace upon deranged people. There is no peace. There's just dope. No person on earth today, no exceptions, not even the Archbishop of York, newly appointed, nobody is entirely at peace. The reason is no individual can be at peace until everybody's at peace. And manifestly everybody's not. And the naughties, like the Hazeltinis, those characters, they're not going to stop blowing people up on the grounds that a new mutant youth has occurred, full of intelligence, harmlessness, one who will not steal another fellow's girl, even if she's good looking. Do you believe it? Do you believe that today's youth is so kind, so considerate, so well developed, that when it sees a good-looking girl in the arms of his best friend, doesn't think, I think my arms are better length than his to fit the torso? Is it or is it not true? Isn't it a kind of myth? And I remember as a child swearing by Almighty God and every other divinity, the lesser gods, I'm going to investigate this thing. There was a man on a poster called Kitchener, and he went, your country needs you. And he wasn't very handsome except for the moustache. And he ordered everybody to fight, and they fought. Some fought voluntarily, and some were conscripted, and there were marvellous errors of judgments made by big brass hats, and a few million people were killed, and they were counted as not terribly important, because actually they weren't terribly important. And the reason was that they did not terribly import into themselves the intelligence that they might have done. So they did what they were told, and they were blown up. And if you were not in uniform in those days, and I saw this personally happen, a man tarred and feathered by irate ladies because he wasn't in uniform. They poured tar on him and threw feathers on him and said, you are a coward. Oh, that was in that war, 1418. I must have been cursed with logic. I thought, he could have been not a coward. He could have been a secret agent. He could have been anything. He didn't deserve tar and feathers. In any case, that cost money and probably went on the taxes. If he's a coward, he's not fit to fight anyway. He should have been ignored. But in the other war, 39, a type of pacifism was allowed. We had grown up a little bit. You could object, especially if you were unfit to fight. Especially if you had no sense. Especially if you were inconsistent. So that if somebody said turn right, you turn left. Nobody of no use was allowed to be pressed into service for the forces. And pacifism became a possibility. And I was a member of an organization called the Peace Pledge Union. I was part of the younger members of society. And I'm supposed to believe what I didn't believe, that the previous war to end all wars had not really ended wars, and this one in which we were now engaged was not to ratify the first one. But it's simply another expression of millions of years of people murdering people. Now, I've seen no evidence whatever amongst the young today not to throw bricks through windows, rip wing mirrors off cars when annoyed, or do other dangerous deeds. I don't see it. If there is a person who thinks singly that he is at a psychological level of development, he's got perfect self-control, so that if another fellow comes and takes his favourite possession, whether girl or mud car or flat or whatever, and he doesn't boil with rage, and he says, of course, have it. I'm all compassion. I'd like to meet him. Is he in this room? Now, is there anybody young enough with enough self-control to say that he would cheerfully give up sacrifice in the spirit of messianic sacrifice, his beautiful girlfriend, his car, his radio, his hi-fi, and give it away cheerfully to a friend, or even better, an enemy, without worrying about it? Or would he not, if he examined himself, find a little bit of annoyance and a tendency to stick a nail in the tire of his friend's car? Can happen. I know a man, a very kind man, very, very kind man. Of course, he's got an excuse of his own. Older than I am, funny enough. And people used to park their cars in his drive. They couldn't get his car in. Why? Because he lived in a charming village called Prestbury. And in the summer, people used to come and they looked for a place to park the car, and there wasn't one. So they parked it in an empty drive, namely his. And he was a very kind man, very kind. Over years and years, I've known him being kind. He used to go about being kind. Kindness shone out of his face. When he saw the cows in his drive, he said to his sister, "My God," he said, "the next man to put a bloody car in my drive and I should let down all his tires." Anyhow, he went away and came back, and behold, there was a car in his drive. So he promptly, technically, correctly, methodically, let down all the tires, dead flat. Then he walked into the house rubbing his hands and said, "I've just let down the tires on that car." And the sister said, "It's my brother's." That really happened in that marvellous village of Prestbury. And they've got a church in Prestbury that's very nice. And people go to it and worship. But that foul deed of letting down of car tires occurred there. Have we really got enough self-control to give up our best treasure freely? And if we haven't in ourselves individually, can we expect other people to have it? Can we expect people with a foreign language to do it? Can we expect the Americans to understand the Russians? They, the Chinese, us? Can we? Or are we just incapable of that thought? I can trust myself not to throw bricks at the Chinese consul if I see him. I've got too much respect for Chinese art. But I'm sure that's the only thing that actually restrains me. I love Chinese paintings on silk, and it would really harm my psyche if I threw a brick at a man with a Chinese face. But how far can our self-control go in practice? It can't go further than we practice identifying with transcendental infinite being. And if we can do that, we can look with ease, kindness, compassion on everybody. We can actually embody Corinthians 13. Love suffereth long, without a long face. Do we believe it? Does anybody not know that it's very, very hard work? My friend Peter here said, how far down do we have permission to go on the road to disintegration, corruption, lost in the abyss, before we change our mind? Now in the Revelation, there's a little answer to that one. It says, they said to Jesus, "When is the last day?" And he said, "Nobody knows that, not even the Son of God. God has kept that one to himself." So that you're caught off guard. And when you're caught, it says, "Let him that stinks, stink still." You're not allowed to reform in the last moment. As the bomb explodes, you're not allowed to say, "Sorry, God, I was just about to repent." He says, "Too late." Why? Does he have to tell you that? No. You do. You know perfectly well you didn't repent until you were hit by the bomb. Buddha said it in a very simple way. When he said, to the born, certain is death. To the compound, certain is disintegration. And your body is compounded, isn't it? Made of cells, made of molecules, made of atoms, made of subatomic particles, wavicles, energy quanta. They're gathered together and held together for a time. They must ultimately disintegrate. What you see before you now here is a shadow of the former self. I'm on the edge of disintegration. A few more years and I will be no more. I will have scattered. As to my molecular and atomic existence, one thing will not scatter, and that is my atmic buddhic self, the Logos. Now if you hang on to that buddhic Logos self, you won't disintegrate. Your body will, but you won't. You'll have a coherence internally. It will save you absolutely. And then you can determine when and where you will reincarnate, if you so desire. If you so will, you can appear anywhere, providing you have clung to Atma Buddhi, Spirit Logos. Mm-hmm. Everything is every finite. I will give you anything finite. And I can't give you infinity because it would bust you wide open. But if I could give you infinity, out of consideration I wouldn't, because it would bust the seams of your garment. But I would if I could. Because you conceive yourself not as identified with the thing, but you conceive yourself as a door. Only a door. Nothing else. A hole through which infinity travels from eternity into time. That's right. And when he said, I am the door, there is one Hebrew letter which means door. It's a fourth letter. Remember that magical four where you have to make your decision on the diagram? And it is spelled Dalet. D-L-T. Now the D itself means a division, and the L means a conjunction, so it means analysis, synthesis, terminal letter T, crucified. You crucify analysis and synthesis on each other, and that is a door. So that whatever comes to you, you actually analyze it immediately and synthesize it and crucify yourself on the analytic, synthetic process. And you are a door. You're a door. You let it go through. So you don't hold it so it can't blow you up. The thing that blows people up mentally very often is hanging on to an erroneous idea that they think they need something essential for their life, but the idea is finite. And because it's finite, when they hang on, it explodes. And if you hang on to infinity, it can't explode. You can only explode if you first implode. First you must blow into the thing all the power you have, hold it in a finite container, and keep blowing it in like a balloon until the skin bursts. There is no explosion without previous implosion. But if you identify with infinity and say, whatever I do, whatever I say, whatever I think, is not a finite, it is infinity passing through me as a door, and I don't own what passes through me. Women that sometimes think, I am the door through which my child came into the world, and then hang on to the child. They're not proper doors. Proper doors say to the baby, oh, grow up, go away, get married, don't bother me, I'm only a door. And then they're not possessive, then they don't explode. And they don't expect anything because they're only a door. In business, it's called passing the buck. When you have to get an order done and the workers don't want to do it, you say, I don't want it done. It's the customer. You pass the buck. You say, well, how about his customer, his customer? Actually, do you know who wants it done? God. God means infinite power, wants it done. And we are modalities of that power. Merely modalities. We're little holes through which it must pass in order to pass from eternity to time to operate visibly, manifestly. And without that manifestation, the infinite would remain unknown. And with the manifestation, we are committed to be doors. But if we know we're only doors, we hang on to nothing. Let it go. There's total freedom from heavy responsibility if you are a doorway to the operation of principle. And if you think you're not a doorway but an owner, you're in trouble.
When you say the attack before the bump, are you saying that a once and for all?
Cannot be. The universe itself is instantly created, instantly demolished, instantly recreated. Your decision must always be instant. Each moment you must make that decision. You can't say, I'll decide to be a decent type now, okay, forever. I sign on the dotted line. And then forget about it. Forgetting about it is no good. It must be reposited instantly. When Jesus says, why hast thou forsaken me? He's saying this, quoting from the Old Testament, and he's saying, if you don't forsake me, I cannot be an individual making an individual decision to agree with you. It will be you talking, and I've got to bring myself to agree with you as from me. And I know that when I'm a door, words come through me and speak, and I'm a door. But I still have the responsibility of agreeing or disagreeing with the words that come through the door. So in order to make them my own, I must be deserted by the Absolute. And in that instant, I must make my mind up whether or not I will be a door. And if I make sure I'm a door, then whatever happens, each instant will be an operation of the eternal into the time process. An instant, a standing in to the time process of the eternal.
So what you're saying then is that the dropping of the atomic bomb will not resolve the problem of violence?
Of course it won't. They've already got the police trained, ready to deal with nuclear rioting after the bomb. They've already got whole piles of new techniques for dealing with mobs of panicky people. The violence will continue for a long, long time after that bomb. Like it has in Japan in the protests against Hiroshima. There are people that protest violently against violence. Is that not true?
What about the people that shot children in Hiroshima?
You mean the dead? Well, they have a problem. When they die, they can either die annoyed or pleased. And if they die annoyed and wanting revenge, the reincarnating children are agitated against the government and demand revenge. Nobody is destroyed. The Atma Buddhi is indestructible. When it comes in, it comes in with an intent to go along the path of development. And it could say, I'll come back kamikaze and I will teach the Americans not to drop bombs. I will drop one on them now, teach them a lesson. That's my mission in life. And there are people like that now. There are people like that even here. There are people like that in the Palestinians, in the Israelis. There are kamikaze Israelis, kamikaze Arabs, everywhere. Kamikaze Irish, fighting for the freedom from the wicked British. Everywhere there are people prepared to die, because they know that life is not worth living unless you're prepared to die. If you're not prepared to die, life is certainly not worth living. I mean, just existing and eating and sleeping and going around, seeing endless stupid plays and films and holiday makings and skin peeling off your back, that isn't existence. That's mere survival at the lowest level. If you're prepared to transcend your present level for a higher level, then life is worth living. And if you're not prepared to transcend it, it isn't. So that when you're lost, blown away, it counts for nothing. When Nietzsche said, what are all the sufferings of these millions of little people in a war? They count for nothing. Each man feels only his own hurt. Is that not true in most cases of war? The cries on the battlefield is, my pain, my pain, my pain, my pain. We're talking now about what is called harsh realities. HR means hierarchical differentiation. Now there are two facts that have to be admitted by any perceptive person. One is the fact of hierarchy, that there are differences of power in the universe. Anybody who thinks there aren't is silly. Because factually, when you're near the Earth, and when you're far from the Earth, the gravitational pull varies according to where you are. That's a hierarchy of power. In society, if you're born at the bottom level with no education and no opportunity to get one, you will not finish up in a certain qualified form as a member of parliament or even a prime minister because you lack the education. There is a hierarchy of power. That is a fact. The fact is that one of your eyes is better focused than the other. The fact is that one of your ears can listen better than another. Try it on the telephone and find out. The fact is that your right and left hands are not the same power. The fact is that your right and left legs are not the same power. This is called the fact of hierarchy, not the theory. The observed fact of hierarchy. That's rule one. Rule two. The law of self-becoming. Every individual being, by its own choice of a course of action, determines its next level of attainment or development. The Sanskrit for that, you can write S-W-A-B-H-A-V-A. Swabhava. Self-becoming. You become what you are by the choices you make. Since you were conceived, even in the womb you were choosing. Shall I lean on the right side, the left side, stretch out my left leg or my right leg? Elbow mummy, let an arm here. Turn over, breathe, swallow the amniotic fluid, try everything. You're doing all kinds of things in that womb without asking your dear mother. And you make your placenta, you grab on her wall of the uterus, you steal her blood, her power, her energy for you to live. That's you, self-becoming. And then when you're extruded, you boil the place down, and as soon as you're able to toddle about, you wreck the place if you can, find all the favourite ornaments, smash them, climb on tables, scratch furniture, try your new little saw on the leg of a Sheraton chair. I remember trying a saw that I was given when I was five. Silly saw, I think it must have been a Woolworths or something. Because it wouldn't saw, and I was valiantly tempted to take the leg off this chair. A nice chair. But I had to use what I had been given because I was a boy. If boys have tools, they use tools. So I was trying, I had to have it explained to me, this is a chair leg, do you know that? That's a chair leg. If you remove that, it will fall over. How very interesting. In that case, I removed another one. Make it symmetrical, then it will fall forwards near. In that case, I removed two at the back. Only my saw was a rotten saw. It was given to me by a woman I never forgave. Because she did not know what a saw was. She thought a saw was a thing like that. She didn't know it had to be able to cut. Looking at this about 20 years later in the bottom drawer, I noticed that the teeth weren't canted and they hadn't been filed. It was a kiddie type saw. You go like this and nothing happened. It's like a drum that doesn't sound, so it doesn't annoy the grown-up. You ever had one of those? Another lady gave me a ball that wouldn't bounce. It was a big ball with a lot of decoration all over it. But it wouldn't bounce. Why? Because it was an indoor ball. Now, if you got a bouncing ball inside, it could go and smash your favorite vase. But this ball would not smash anything. And I had a very low opinion of the lady that gave it to me. I never spoke to her again. My mother, with all her best persuasive powers, failed to persuade me to give that woman credit for intelligence. No, she hadn't bought me a bouncer ball. She'd bought me a civilized ball. I've never liked civilization since. I mean, I put up with it to a degree, but I'm not in love with it because it's killed spontaneity. It has killed creativity. Michelangelo, Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, they're not civilized beings. They live among civilized beings, but they're not civilized. Civilization is a dreadful disease. But we have to endure these diseases as long as we're amongst them. But somewhere in between, we might find an opportunity for a little spontaneity. The important one, I was just talking with Gordon a little earlier about this, because he'd been commissioned to write some articles about it, and he's already done some. The important thing is this, to let people know that the main reason for the interest today in yoga, meditation, and such like arts, and there are arts, is a negative reason of fear of the external world rushing towards self-destruction, and they want something more valuable, more permanent, more reliable than nuclear weapons. So they're being forced in through fear. But there is another way. Go in because it's more intelligent. Don't wait till you're scared stiff of being blown up. Say it is actually more intelligent, more efficient, more harmonious, and qualitatively better in every way to be inside oneself in full charge of one's own will, one's own feelings, one's own emotions, one's own physical activities, for self-determination, where you can cooperate intelligently. Now the function of this threat is to force people to consider their relationships with each other. Doesn't it make a lot of people get together in order to protest that would otherwise not get together at all? Hasn't it done that with the women of Greenham Common? Isn't it driving lots of people to consider and get together? But the real thing is to get together in oneself, the body, the emotions, the mentations, the conceptual life, the volition and consciousness itself must be made continuously self-aware in a reflexive act, and that is the value of that war. Now if that war doesn't come, I can prophesy something else, because we cannot evolve except under pressure. When we're not pressurized, we don't evolve. We relax. And we dream away. We have no ground, no reason to develop unless we are pressurized. So if that war does not come, we're going to have something else. You know what it will be? Terrible thing, and Nietzsche was terribly aware of it in the 19th century. Internal disease, breakdown, neurosis, psychosis. The war will have gone on the inside of the human being because it's been suppressed. And there will be a total breakdown of human mentalities throughout the world, and an outburst of vandalism everywhere. And there will be civil war. One city will fight another city next to it, because that energy cannot do nothing. Energy cannot do nothing. And if it's not used constructively, it is used destructively. And suppose I'm without warning, say, okay, I won't be neurotic, I'll meditate. I will actually conquer it. What's going to happen instead? No wars, no neurosis, I'll tell you. Earthquakes, cataclysm, plagues. Sorrow must come, because we can't evolve without pressure. How do we like that? Sorrow must come, woe to him by whom? Do we like it? No. Are we going to get it? Yes. Are we going to get it by our own choice, or wait till somebody else slams us with it? In whose translation? One translation is sorrow, another is offence. The offence causes the sorrow. The sorrow is because you've been offended. The Messiah himself is called the great offence and the man of sorrows. Is that not so? You stick your neck out and declare yourself the Messiah, like they tried to make Krishnamurti do in 1928, and you've got sorrow. You've been doing penance ever since. Although he rejected it, he's been doing penance because people will believe about him things that he knows are not true. No. You could offend yourself on the inside with your self-image. Lots of people have very low opinions of themselves which offend them on the inside. Isn't that true? Have you never had a low opinion of yourself in an off moment? It needn't come from outside. There is nothing that can come from outside, that is from the macrocosm, to the microcosm inside that is not already inside. If you hadn't got it in you, you couldn't respond to it presented from outside. A man of sorrow is acquainted with grief on the inside, not only on the outside. I mean, being crucified by people on the outside is relatively simple. But crucifying oneself on the inside by making oneself obey principle inside is very hard, painful work. There is nothing outside that is not inside. The reason is very, very simple. Ultimate reality is a continuum of sentient power. The continuum has no parts. What has no parts is throughout itself identical. When you draw a circle and say inside, outside, you've drawn the circle inside the continuum. The circle is in and of the continuum. We can finish up on that horrible note if you like. We have a fact, hierarchy. Another fact, self-becoming by self-choice of courses of action and life. And there is nothing inside that is not outside, because ultimate reality is a continuum. And we can be caught out by that missile, or we can be ready. But we can only be ready in the instant we remember. If we remember to be as kind as we can be, as helpful as we can be to each other, and a missile hits us now, we're okay. Because when we remember those things, when we remember universal, intelligent compassion, we are at buddhi level. And that buddhi is nothing but the formal side of the atma, of the spirit. So we're absolutely safe the instant, that very short instant that we gather ourselves together before we get hit. If we're hit first, we are condemned by our own self-knowledge that we had not done it. I'll leave you with that candle.
Thank you.